Welcome to Warning Shots here this Friday. This is Alex Patterson back in the booth with you. I'm being assisted by Michael Welch here on the board. It's been a while since I've been here on Warning Shots, and I'm bringing to you a three-part series diving in depth into climate change and some of the issues surrounding being an environmentalist addressing climate change. And the first episode I'm bringing to you is an interview that I did along with Elena Lajoie O'Malley from the Campus Sustainability Office here at the University of Winnipeg, where we interviewed David Suzuki. And there's been a lot of interviews with Suzuki that have been floating around recently, but this one, the unique part about this interview is that it brings to the forefront a despairing Suzuki as he reflects on his life as an environmentalist and where we need to go to address the climate change situation. And I hope that people are really interested in seeing that side of David Suzuki. We're going to jump into the news briefs that we have prepared for this week. These are your briefs. The BBC News Service reports 40% of fish caught off the east coast of Japan remain unfit for human consumption based on government regulations of radioactivity levels. According to U.S. Marine chemist Ken Busiele, the source of the radioactivity is likely twofold: contaminated groundwater under Fukushima seeping into the ocean, and the original contamination of ocean sediment from the actual disaster when the Daiichi power plant blew up and released that sediment. GermanForeignPolicy.com reports the German government has announced that the German army will intervene in Mali. Following Chancellor Merkel's declaration on Monday, Foreign Minister Westerwelle confirmed Tuesday that Berlin wants to stabilize Mali and therefore send soldiers to train Mali's military for war against the insurgents in the north of this West African country. Since the beginning of this year, the Tuareg militia has controlled northern Mali. A militant Islamist faction soon took over command of the militia. This development is a direct consequence of NATO's war on Libya, which destroyed the fragile equilibrium in the economically precarious desert bordering regions. Disregarding this fact, Berlin reacts to this disastrous situation caused in Mali by Western aggression by calling for another intervention. As in Somalia, the war against Mali's insurgents is supposed to be waged by African troops, with Western contingents stationed at a safe distance, preparing to carry out concrete combat assignments. So that means they're going to fight, is what I'm reading there, but they're trying to euphemize it away. Weekly news updates on America's reports. Using tear gas and water cannons, hundreds of federal and state police ended student occupations at three teachers' colleges in southwestern Mexican state of Michoacán. In the early morning of October 15th, protesters and other students were beaten in the rage, which resulted in the arrest of 176 students. The students were demanding a one-year postponement of changes to the curriculum that would require them to study English and computer science. They also sought an increase in the number of fourth-level students. Mexico's rural teachers' colleges, which largely provide instruction for campesino and indigenous students, has suffered from neglect and budget cuts for years and have been a focal point for protests. This was the second major protest at the Michoacán school so far this school year. CBC's Quirks and Quarks blog reports Canada has won the embarrassing Dodo Award from the Convention on Biological Diversity Alliance at a UN conference on biodiversity currently taking place in India. The award is given to countries that have failed to evolve and whose actions contribute to rather than prevent the loss of biodiversity. Canada was chosen because of a recent uncontrolled geoengineering experiment off the coast of British Columbia, where 100 tons of iron-rich material was dumped into the Pacific Ocean by a private company in an attempt to increase fish stocks and absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. This action is in violation of a moratorium on ocean fertilization and geoengineering adopted by the Convention on Biodiversity in 2008 and 2010. And those are your briefs. So we're going to jump into a song by Rise Against called Collapse. And then we'll go directly into the interview with David Suzuki.
Oral History Center Students Association invites students, faculty, and community members to take part in the first Oral History Center student conference ever. If you've ever wanted to know what oral history is, how it can empower communities, and offer new approaches to historical research, then come to Bryce Hall in 2B23 at the University of Winnipeg, Friday, October 26th from 7 to 9:30 p.m. and Saturday, October 27th from 10 to 4 p.m. to network and explore all that the Oral History Center has to offer. Find us online at Oral History Center on Facebook.
Eve Engler, author of six previous books, including The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy and Canada and Israel Building Apartheid, is touring the country to discuss his latest book, The Ugly Canadian, Stephen Harper's Foreign Policy. Join us Sunday, October 28th at 1 o'clock p.m. in room 3C01 at the University of Winnipeg to hear from the man referred to as Canada's Noam Chomsky and one of the most important voices on the left today. Sponsored by the Council of Canadians Winnipeg Chapter, Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, Rabble.ca, and CKUW 95.9 FM.
So the first question that we have for you is, what do you think of the current course being set in addressing climate change coming out of Rio Plus 20?
I didn't pay any attention to what was coming out of Rio Plus 20. I went down there as a babysitter for my daughter, who decided that she was going to go down and reprise the speech she gave 20 years ago when she was 12 years old. But I personally feel that all of these conferences are doomed to fail. So, I just don't want to spend time taking part in them. What was the final agreement, do you know?
I don't even think they had a legitimate final
Canada
agreement.
Canada was down there with the United States doing everything they could to monkey wrench the whole process. So, I mean, I just don't, you know, we've played that role for several years now, and I don't see that we can expect much to come out of it. But fundamentally, these kinds of processes are doomed because we keep putting ourselves up as the most important thing on the planet. And we draw lines around our property, our cities, our provinces, our countries, and we act as if these lines somehow, these boundaries, enable us to manage the planet. I mean, we have salmon that are born in Canadian rivers and go out through Alaska into the ocean. I mean, how do we manage a fish that doesn't give a damn about human boundaries or air? You know, I tell the people in Alberta, I don't give a damn what you do with the tar sand. Develop it all you want, as long as you don't affect the air that I breathe or the water that I drink. Well, of course, you can't do it that way. But we go to Rio and we think we're going to have 192 countries all acting as if their national boundaries are sacrosanct. They're going to deal with something that doesn't belong to anybody. And then, you know, we create these things called economies, a human construct, and then we have to decide on what the fate of the atmosphere is, depending on whether it's economically feasible. Well, I mean, you can't change our need for air, but you can sure as hell change your economy so it serves the air. But we put human-created things, our boundaries and our constructs, you know, markets and economies and corporations and capitalism, we act as if those are things that are going to determine how we behave in the world. Well, it's suicidal.
I totally agree with you there. I guess the challenge that I come across in dealing with that would be when I say do door-to-door canvassing and I talk to a resource extraction worker, often I think that maybe a doom and gloom message has hit them so hard that it's come to this point where people are responding with, well, I'll be dead anyway, kind of attitude to that. And it's those types of apathetic attitudes that I don't know how to reach. And I'm wondering if you have had any success in talking to people at that point.
No, I've been a total failure. I don't know why you're even bothering to call and ask me. I mean, I've been in, ever since Rachel Carson, we're talking 50 years now since Rachel Carson published Silent Spring, we had the enormous growth of the environmental movement. We got departments of the environment at every level of government. We've got laws that are supposed to regulate, you know, clean air, clean water. We've got laws supposedly protecting endangered species. But what's happening? The planet is still under assault by humans, and we're going backwards. Things are way worse now than they were 50 years ago when the environmental movement began its roots or its growth. And part of the problem is people say, oh, you're so depressing, you know, like, don't scare the kids, don't tell them. So we're somehow supposed to put on a happy face and say, oh, well, you know, all you have to do is turn out the lights and be sure not to turn off the tap when you're brushing your teeth. And somehow this is going to get us off the destructive path we're on and everything's going to be fine. Well, I think that we have to confront the reality of where we're going. If you're heading straight at a brick wall at 100 miles an hour in a car, I think it would be foolhardy for people to say, well, don't give us the bad news. That's too depressing. I mean, put on a happy face.
If we want to be able to deliver that kind of bad news, what kind of solutions or what kind of levers can we sort of help people or talk to people about? Like,
I just told you, I've been a total failure. I have no idea. I have no idea. I cannot see, you know, we now have a prime minister who has been an asthmatic since childhood. He has, while he's been in office, he's been taken to the emergency ward of the hospital with a severe asthma attack. I would have thought anybody with asthma would know that when you put shit in the air, you put shit in your body, and that maybe we ought to do something to clear it up. He won't even talk to me, so I have no idea what the answer is.
I guess I'm interested in knowing then, for those people who are moving forward and we're actually trying to build something.
What is moving forward?
Well, that's a good question.
The problem is that we're all caught up in a system. You see, I've got lots of friends who have companies, you know, like Roots and Interface Carpets and Body Shop, who know what the problem is. But in order to stay in business, they have to play by the rules of an economic system that is inevitably destructive of the planet. And so if we don't face up to the fact that we're just playing games at the edges, but we're not confronting the reality of the fact, our economic system is absolutely out of sync with the very things that keep us alive. And if we don't change that, we're hooped.
So if we're changing it, what's it going to look like? If you can close your eyes and imagine a completely rejigged economic system.
I'm not an economist. I have no idea. I can only look at the economic system as it affects me and realize that it's a totally insane system. If you, where I encountered that was when we were fighting for a valley in British Columbia, and I met the CEO of the company that had been given permission to log the valley. We got into a very heavy screaming match, and finally he said, "Listen, Suzuki, are tree huggers like you willing to pay to protect those trees? Because if you're not willing to pay for them, they don't have any value till someone cuts them down." And that for me was my epiphany when I realized the insanity of the economic system, because he was absolutely right. You see, as long as the forest is standing and is healthy, it's taking carbon out of the air and putting oxygen back in it. Not a bad service for an animal like us. If there weren't plants in the world, we wouldn't be around. And yet economists call that an externality. It's not in the economic equation. That forest is taking millions of gallons of water out of the soil, pumping it into the atmosphere and affecting weather and climate. That's an externality. The roots cling to the soil, so when it rains, it doesn't run into the spawning grounds of the salmon. That's an externality. The forest supports countless pollinating insects that pollinate flowering plants. So many things that forest is doing that keep the planet habitable for an animal like us, and economists completely discount them because they consider them irrelevant to the economic equation. And then, to make matters even worse, economists actually believe that the economy can grow forever, which it cannot. Not only do they believe it can, but it must grow forever. Indeed, the very definition of progress today is on the amount that the economy has grown. Ask any politician or business person, how well did you do last year? And they'll immediately tell you good or bad, depending on whether the economy or their business grew. Well, we live within the confines of a very thin layer called the biosphere that circles the planet. Carl Sagan told us, if you reduce the Earth to the size of a basketball, the biosphere, the air, water, and land where all living things live, would be thinner than a layer of saran wrap. And that's it. That's our home and the home for 30 million other species. And it can't grow. So what kind of a creature would think that we can invent an economy that will and must grow forever? That's what cancer cells believe. And you know what the end result is if they're allowed to try to grow forever. It's impossible.
I'm interested to know what you think, what measure of value should be then in an economy, or what our basic good has to be like. What is the primary?
Well, I worry because economists actually are so conceited, they think they can put a value on everything. You know, you want to put a value on love. How much do you love your wife? If you get a divorce, well, we can put a value on that. We got to put a value on air. We got to put a value on water. Well, I happen to think some things are sacred. They are far beyond any economic value. What is the most important thing that every one of us needed the minute we left our mother's body? Of course, it's a breath of air. And from that moment on, from the moment we were born to the last breath we take before we die, we need air 15 to 40 times a minute. And we filter whatever that is in that air when we take it into our bodies. And we don't even think about it. You know, we just use air as a resource to dump our toxic chemicals. We sure as hell don't want to pay to do that. Nobody wants a carbon tax. We don't want to pay to put any crap into the air. And we think somehow that's not going to affect us. To me, air should be regarded as sacred in the same way that water and the soil that gives us our food and all of the energy that plants capture from sunlight through photosynthesis, that should be sacred. Those are the things that enable life on Earth to exist. And they're in a totally different category from the things that we do to create an economy. They're priceless. And therefore, they ought to be protected and nurtured as one of our highest priorities. Instead, we have a prime minister now who says, oh, well, we can't do anything about greenhouse gas emissions or pollution because it'll destroy the economy. So the economy, a human-created thing, comes before the very stuff that keeps us alive. And that's the problem we face now. We don't value things that are beyond economic worth. They're priceless, and therefore should be our highest priority to protect. But we just regard it as another resource.
So what would you think of strategies aimed at creating sort of legal mechanisms around doing that, like creating a charter for the rights of the planet or the rights of the Earth?
Well, it's very interesting. I just came back from Ecuador because we were doing a film. And there, Mr. Correa is the president of Ecuador. He's an economist. And he has instituted, or he has ensconced, Pachamama, which is Mother Earth, in the Constitution. So he rewrote the Constitution. And when he did it, he put Pachamama as something that has a constitutional right to be protected. Now, that's all very fancy words, but what is the result? Well, one result is that an American couple living in the southern part of Ecuador on the Vilcabamba River saw a road being brought into the valley, and the engineers were dumping the rock and the gravel that they were digging out of the mountainside, just dumping it over the edge into this river, and the river was getting plugged up. And they kept saying to the government, look, you got to do something. This river is being destroyed. And finally, a huge storm came. The water ripped down this river and tore out a huge part of their property. And they then sued the road building company, which is a government company, on behalf of the Vilcabamba River under the Constitution, which guaranteed the rights of that river to be healthy. And when you do that, you can't claim money because you're suing on behalf of the river. And they sued and won, and now they have to stop dumping crap into the river, and they have to restore the river that they've ruined to its original shape. So that's a very, very powerful mechanism to start protecting the environment, it seems to me.
Is there a more powerful mechanism that you could imagine that we could institute in Canada, or would it be something very similar to that mechanism?
Well, quite frankly, I think that we are screwed as long as we continue to look at the world through the eyes that we have now. You keep hearing in the environmental movement the need for a paradigm shift, the paradigm shift. It's a cliche, but it's absolutely true. You see, I got involved in environmental things after Rachel Carson published Silent Spring, and we fought, and you know, we fought in British Columbia a proposal to drill for oil in Heckett Strait, and we stopped it about 35 years ago. We got a moratorium. I fought against a dam to be built at built at Site C on the Peace River, and we stopped it. I did many shows on American plans to drill for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and we stopped it. But guess what? 30, 35 years later, we're still fighting again. They're now going to build the dam at Site C on the Peace River. They want to drill for oil in Heckett Strait. They want to go into the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I joined with the Kayapo in the Amazon in 1988, and we stopped a series of dams that the Brazilian government was going to build in their watershed. Well, guess what? The dam is back on the agenda, and they're building it again. What does that mean? When we were battling in those early years, when we won, we didn't shift the way that we see the world. So the mindset is still there. We still want to go in and destroy. We didn't really understand that we had to live in a different way. So the challenge is this. We now exist in a world in which we think we're the top organism, that we're at the top and the world is there for us to use in any way we want. And you see that in what's often referred to as a triple bottom line. You've heard that, right? So what they do is we say, okay, well, here's a circle. That's society. That's us. And here's another circle. It's the same size, and that's the economy. And here's another circle. That's the same size, and that's the environment. And those three circles overlap. And where all three overlap together, that's the sweet spot. If we do all of our activity there, we benefit the triple bottom line. We benefit environment, society, and the economy. Well, what could be more absurd than thinking this is what the challenge is? Are we saying that we, society, are as big as the environment? That's what we're implying with circles of the same size. And then are we implying the economy is as big as society and as big as the environment? This is absolutely nuts. But this is the way we see the world. We call it an anthropocentric way of seeing the world. Humans are at the center of it all. What we have to do is shift to a radically different way of seeing the world. And that is one big circle, and that's the biosphere. That's the air, water, and land where all life exists. And within that that big circle, are 30 million other circles of differing size. And those are all of the other species that live within the biosphere. But what's happened is right now, one of those species, us, is now occupying 40% of that biosphere. We say that we are now using 40% of the net primary productivity. That is what drives life on the planet. Is all of the energy captured by plants through photosynthesis. That's the energy that we need to live and survive, and all other species do. We've taken over 40% of that. So obviously, we've got to shrink our size way down. We're way too big. And within that big circle that's us, there should be another smaller circle, and that's the economy. And the economy is already far too big as well. So this... the challenge is to see the world through biocentric eyes and shift the paradigm from an anthropocentric one. And quite frankly, we haven't budged that at all since the environmental movement started in 1962. So we're still seeing the world as if we are the most important thing, and therefore our society and our economy have got to be served before anything else.
Do you see a group or a series of groups in Canada who are already leading the way or cutting that edge in Canada?
Because there are individuals, there are organizations that are trying, but quite frankly, we're under heavy attack right now by the most right-wing ideological government that we've ever had. And the environmental movement, which is seen as an impediment to the economy, but especially an impediment to the tar sands access, the environmental movement is regarded as an enemy, and attacking it. The government is attacking it heavily. So what you see is an environmental community under siege. But there are pockets of individuals, of people. You just have to look for them. The Transition Town movement is a very interesting one that started in England and is spread across North America. But that's basically saying, look, we can't look to the federal governments. We've got to start making communities that are much more self-sustaining and self-reliant, because there are going to be catastrophic changes coming. We're entering a period now when scientists say that it's no longer about holding off climate change. We're entering a period of climate chaos where everything's changed now because we've added too much carbon to the atmosphere. And what the consequences will be, we simply don't know. To continue to exacerbate the problem is simply to accelerate what is already a very, very chaotic situation. So, yeah, there are individuals and groups, but I don't think any of us really have a handle on where we have to go.
I'd also like maybe for you to talk explicitly and directly towards people who think, say, the NDP is an alternative to the Harper regime, because when I look at them in a debate, the NDP is completely shut down whenever the conservatives say, well, we have to balance the environment with
did a thing while I was in South America on Amy Goodman's show, Democracy Now. And she pulled some clips that I'd never heard. They're now calling Obama George W. Obama. And when you listen to these clips, he's just saying full tilt, although he came in saying we've got to come to grips with reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, he's now opening every tap and saying we're getting more oil in America than we ever did. We've got pipelines that will circle the planet. He sounds like George Bush. And Ralph Nader has said this for years, that Democrats and Republicans don't sound very different. And certainly, if the NDP is going to get into the arena and discuss politics, but within the context of the need to service the economy, as long as we keep throwing the economy up, we're stuck in the wrong debate. I've supported Elizabeth May and the Green Party for years, but I keep saying there shouldn't be a Green Party. The problem is that when we create a Green Party, then everybody acts as if the environment is their issue. So you saw it in the last leaders' debate when Elizabeth was not allowed to debate. Then the journalists acted as if, well, the Greens aren't here, so we don't have to talk about the environment. What the hell is going on? The environment is not a political issue. It's something affecting all of us. And right now, we've got a government that is acting as if the environment is a pain in the ass. It's an impediment. This is just crazy. We haven't come to understand that the air, the water, the soil, the biodiversity are the very things that we depend on for our survival and our well-being. The economy is a subset that exists because of the state of the environment. But we keep using the argument that the economy has got to be served, and then I don't care whether it's the NDP or the Conservatives or the Liberals. You're going to get, basically, they're twitching or fooling around with the economy, but not dealing in a serious way with the environment.
You were speaking earlier about some of the failures of the past around the environmental movement, and I'm wondering how much of the challenges have been because of too much effort being put into sort of trying to accommodate the language and the vocabulary of the status quo and sort of trying to say, oh, this is normal and there's nothing radical about this. I mean,
well, I think you've put your finger on a very important point. Our foundation did this. We did a thing called the Nature Challenge, the 10 most effective things that individuals can do to reduce our footprint. And I even toured several cities giving speeches about the Nature Challenge and take this on, and if 33 million Canadians do the Nature Challenge, we will radically and it's true, it will have an impact. But I mean, we fool ourselves if we think as long as we're doing all of these reduction effects and living right, that we can go on having iPad 6s and iPad 10s and more Nike shoes, and that we will, all we have to do is be more careful. No, we can't. We have to look to economies that are static or shrinking. That's why I'm looking at Japan, which has had a static economy for the last 20 years, and they're not in great serious trouble as far as I can see. So we've got to be looking at that kind of of economy, and that means you're not going to have this, you know, the supporting the Walmarts of the world and having more titillating things for us to go and buy and play with. We're going to have to live in a radically different way. There have never been 7 billion human beings on the planet. There have never been a billion mammals on the planet. We're the first mammal to achieve this state, and now there are 7 billion of us. We've got to start living in a radically different way. And we fool ourselves if we think, oh, well, we just have to reduce our energy use and be more careful, and we'll be able to have stores filled with stuff. No, I don't think so.
So earlier you used the word sacred, and a lot of what you're talking about is us having to really radically change our relationship to our appetites and to our desires for things. So to what extent is this project almost a spiritual project of transformation?
Well, I think that we need a sense of spirit, and I don't mean in a formal religious sense. I'm an atheist, but I believe very strongly that we need some sense of that we emerged from nature, and when we die, we go back out and get recycled into nature, that there are sacred places that we go with respect and veneration, not looking for opportunity, that there are things in nature we will never understand or control, that the biosphere is our home. We've got to understand and see ourselves in this way. The challenge is this, that 1929, when the stock market collapsed, we were ushered into a Great Depression that, you know, it was a very, very tough time. And my parents became adults during the 30s. And the result of that time was they taught me a lot of things that I try to teach my children, which is to live within your means, save some for tomorrow. You have to work hard to make money to buy the things you need, but not the things you want. Share with your neighbors. Don't be greedy. You may need your neighbors at some other time and need them to help you. I mean, these kinds of homilies, I am sure most people my age were taught by their parents because that's what they learned out of the Depression. Well, what brought us out of the Depression was World War II. Wars are very good at getting economies going. And as World War II was coming to an end, the President of the United States established a Council of Economic Advisors to the President, and he said, I want you to tell me, how do we make a transition from a wartime economy to a peacetime economy? We can't keep producing guns and tanks and bullets and planes. What is a peacetime economy? And the answer came back, consumption. We've got to make consumption an American way of life. Get Americans to worship at the altar of consumption. Buy things, use them up, throw them away, and buy more. And it worked. So that 70% of the North American economy now is based on consumption. But it's not about the things we need. It's about things that we want. And there's no end to what we want. And that's the challenge now, is that we've built an economic system that is designed to make us use more and more stuff. And all of that comes out of the earth. So the transformation that is needed is a very, very profound one. Now, people go, oh, well, you know, this is crazy. You can't change the economy. When World War II was coming to an end, 44 countries met at Bretton Woods in Maine in 1944. And they said, how do we get the economies growing in a war-torn world? And John Maynard Keynes was the leading economist at that meeting. And leaders of all the 44 nations were there. And they invented GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. They invented the World Bank. They invented the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. And they tied world currency to the American greenback. And it worked. I mean, you think the two countries that were pounded into the ground were Japan and Germany, and they became two of the most powerful economies in the world. The only problem was they left out the atmosphere. They left out the biosphere. So it's not true that you can't change the economy. In fact, it's the one thing you can change. You can't change our need for clean air, clean water, clean soil, clean energy, or biodiversity. That's built into us. We are biological creatures. But in the environment, I mean, the economy, capitalism, markets, these are not forces of nature, we invented them. And if they're not working, those at least we can change. We can change nature, but we can change those things that we invent. So we've got to stop falling down before this economic system. Of course, it's going to lead to huge changes. There will be a huge number of corporations that will go out of existence if we get an economy that is truly in balance with the world. But, you know, are we going to talk about survival of corporations or survival of our species? I don't think there's any choice.
I guess one of the most interesting things for me coming out of this conversation is that this is not the David Suzuki of my childhood. This is not the level of frustration that I hear in your voice is not the heartened wow that I got while watching The Nature of Things.
You're absolutely right.
And I'm wondering, where's your motivation coming from these days to continue this fight? Because at the start of our interview, there was a lot of discussion and humbling about your own failures. Where do you still get that motivation to keep
fighting? First of all, I long ago lost the conceit that I was so important, I was going to make the difference. You know, I used to carry the weight of the world around and think, oh, I've got to do this. I can't stop now. I've got to do this. I got to do that. Who the hell did I think I was? I mean, I'm one person. But if millions and millions of individual people like me are doing their little bit, maybe that could add up to a huge force. But for me, long ago, I lost the conceit that I was so important that I was the one that was going to make the difference. It's not. It's going to be the collective impact of a lot of other people. But what moves me and continues, you know, I'm an old man. I'm in the last part of my life. I tell people I'm in the death zone. And what that does, it sure as hell sharpens my mind. I have no desire for more fame or money or power, but I do have some very young grandchildren, and they are every bit of my motivation. Because my generation and the boomers that followed, in all of this expansion of fulfilling our desires and our egos, we've left a bloody mess for our grandchildren. And I just happen to think that that's wrong, that's not right. And I've got every obligation. All I hope is at the end of my life, I hope my grandchildren will be gathered around me and I'll be able to look them in the eye and say, Grandpa did the best he could. And that's all you can ask of any person. And I did it for you.
So if you're standing in what you're calling the death zone now and looking at your children and grandchildren, what advice are you giving them for how to move forward?
Well, I'm telling them they have no choice but to become very active in politics. By that, I don't mean running as political candidates, but they've got to take part in the political process. The problem, you see, is right now we have a political system where when politicians are elected, their absolutely first priority is getting reelected. And what does that mean? It means whatever you do has to pay off before the next election so that you can brag about that and get reelected. Well, guess what? Kids don't vote. For that matter, future generations don't even exist. So how could any politician, and I'm not saying they're evil or stupid, but it is the nature of the political game that they cannot go before the public and say, if you vote for me, I'm going to commit billions of dollars every year so that future generations will have cleaner air or a better future. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So what I say is to young people, you go to the two most important people on the planet. That's your mom and dad. And if they don't become eco-warriors on your behalf, if they don't go to meetings, all candidates' meetings, if they don't demand of people that are running for office, what the hell are you doing about the future for my children? Because I'm going to hold you accountable. You've got the right and the power to make decisions that are going to affect them. Now start doing it with them in mind. That's what I mean about getting political. And I'm telling elders, get off the goddamn golf course, get off the beaches, and start doing the most important thing in your life. You've lived a life. Now, surely to heavens, you've learned something in that life. Get out and start telling people what the hell you've learned, and get active in telling young people what we have to work towards, because we have a big debt to those children. We've left a mess for them, and it's not right. You know, the economic system, when you decide what is the cost of adding more greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, we discount the impact on future generations. We say, oh, well, the cost of dealing with it today is a dollar per whatever it is. But for the next generation, it'll be cheaper because we'll have advanced more technology and it'll be easier and cheaper. So we discount the impact of what we're doing on the generation that is going to feel it even more than we are feeling it today. It's just not right. And so we've got to change this system. And to do that, you have to be active.
It's interesting. You talked about getting sort of going to forums and candidates' debates and so on and so forth. And during the whole lead up to the passing of Bill C-38, there was obviously a lot of frustration and anger in Winnipeg, as I'm sure there was all over the country. And I had a lot of people asking me, well, what can I do? And it was really underwhelming to think about the things that people could do, given the fact that we have a majority government. You know, oh, well, you can write a letter to your MP, or you can do this.
I think that we have to take back democracy, and the reality is that we do not have a democracy. Right now, we have a defective system, which is the first-past-the-post system. My mother and father were born and raised in Canada. They lived in Canada all their lives, and yet they couldn't vote until long after World War II because they happened to be of Japanese descent. So I take the right to vote very, very seriously. I have voted studiously in every single federal election since I turned 21. I have never voted for a party that got into power in all those years because we have a system called First Past the Post, in which we can have a majority government that receives 38, 39, 40% of the vote. So we've got a defective system, but that system is called a parliamentary system. And as I understand it, in a parliamentary system, we don't, as an electorate, we don't vote for the prime minister. We vote for party. The party elects the leader who becomes prime minister. But the party presents to the electorate a platform and tells us exactly what they are going to do, and we select the party we vote for based on the platform we're offered. And what's happening now is that we've given, with a minority of the electorate, we have given Mr. Harper a majority, and he's now acting as if the majority mandate means he can do anything he wants. We never voted on what the future of the Experimental Lakes area is. We never voted on canceling the long-form census or three. We never voted on whether to cancel Arctic research into climate change. We've never voted on all kinds of things. And yet we have a government that acts as if, with a majority, it can do anything it wants. And I think it's up to Canadians now to start demanding that we get a return. We're stuck now. We're stuck with a government that says it's going to live out its mandate. I want you to remind you, this is a government that every time has run on a law and order part of its platform. They believe in law and order. And yet, Mr. Chrétien, when he ratified Kyoto and committed Canada to Kyoto, he didn't do that as a liberal. He did that as the Prime Minister of Canada and committed Canada to an international agreement. Now, by declaring that we were pulling out of the Kyoto Protocol, Mr. Harper has said, I don't care about international laws. So we declared that we are international bandits. And then, before that, Mr. Harper passed a law that said we will have elections every 4 years on a specified date. And within months, he broke his own law and called an election. So we have to ask ourselves, what kind of a government is it that will turn its back on the laws that are supposedly binding on this government, that would prorogue Parliament twice in order to be defeated in a vote in the House, that would come into power saying it wanted an elected Senate and yet immediately load that Senate with conservatives and use the Senate then to defeat a bill that had passed through Parliament demanding that Canada live up to its Kyoto agreements. I mean, Canadians really ought to think hard about what a democracy is and what kind of a government we have. If, in fact, the robocalls are an indication of a party misusing the telephone system to actually undermine people's ability to vote properly, this is undermining the very heart of what is a democracy. I think that we need Canadians to really start standing up and fighting for what we claim is a country based on democratic principle.
What I'm hearing from you.
So that was David Suzuki in an interview with Alex Patterson, myself, and Alana Lajoie O'Malley. It was a really interesting interview to see where David Suzuki has gone and the less kind and cuddly version of his thoughts. We're going to end this show off with a song by Gojira called Global Warming, and they're a francophone metal band.